Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Give it to me. Give it to me. Hey, I'm Molly Wood.
And I'm Tom Merritt. Give it
to me. And welcome back to It's a Thing, the podcast where we brilliantly observe the latest and greatest and just over the horizon trends that will arrive. Actually, it could be trends that are like 2 to 7 years old, really, but we're going to talk about them.
I like to think, Molly, that we exist outside of time and we just sort of survey the vista of trends, past, present, and future. Oh.
And we give them a little, oh my God, okay, that's so amazing that you're saying that right now, because I just finished last night the Three Body Problem trilogy.
So your head's right in that space, isn't it?
So outside of time, yeah, exactly. I'm like, whoa, dude, are you in my brain right now? Is that what? Happening?
I actually just read an article in Scientific American about quantum monism. So that's where that came from.
Oh, okay. What? Quantum who now?
I won't bother to explain because I'm not sure I can or am qualified to, but the rough version is it has to do with like the universe being observed from outside the universe.
Oh, okay. Huh. Well, I mean, I guess that also happened at the, oh, I can't say. Never mind. No spoilers.
Yeah,
you know,
catch up.
Interestingly, so wait, have you not read all three?
Only read the first one.
Okay, so funny story. Even though technically this was not going to be my thing for today, it's a little mini thing because apparently the three body problem is a thing among a certain group of nerds. And part of the reason, well, just people, part of the reason for that is that Barack Obama read it. Read the whole trilogy and talked with, you know, that New York Times book critic, the really, really well-known one, Michiko Kakutani. Uh-huh. She like retired and there was a whole parade in the streets. Like she was, you know, she was the ultimate authority on books.
Sure. Yeah.
And she had this whole long conversation with Obama about books that really like formed him, were formative for him as a young man. And one of them was The Three Body Problem.
As a young man?
What? Which made me really quiet. I was like, really?
Because it just got translated not that long ago.
I know.
The conversation must have ranged around.
Oh, I see. The impact that books have had on him throughout his lifetime. So he talks about books that he read when he was pretty young. And then
unless he was trying to say, I time traveled.
Right. I time traveled to this thing. But yeah, so he talked all about it. And so then it became like a Reddit thread. And I think that then there were a whole bunch of people who went and read it. And part of the reason, because I only read it because it was suggested to me on Twitter, like, oh, you would probably like this book. And then it just became this whole thing.
We read it on Sword and Laser, but I don't remember how it came to us. I know we were familiar with Ken Liu, who did the translation. And I feel like that's how it was. But it was a couple of years ago before it really took off. But now I'm wondering, did someone read that article and then tell us on Goodreads, you should read this because I heard about it in this article? It's quite possible that that was it too. But it was one of those things where it was the only one translated at the time that we read it. So I couldn't read the second one. Then the second one came out. And by the time the second one came out, I was like, well, I'm reading this other thing. I got to, you know, make time for that later. And I still got to do that.
Oh, yeah. You know what? You really have to because, whoa. I mean, I've now obviously spent the last like 2 months or so just completely immersed in this trilogy. But I want you to know that I have now started A Brief History of Time because I'm like, okay, I feel like I'm finally ready to, I'm like qualified now to read some Stephen Hawking because I read The Three Body Problem. I'm up on my physics enough that I'll be able to keep up.
Yeah, you can go read some Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman. You can read some Hawking. You can just dive into some Michio Kaku.
I don't know what you're talking about, but Stephen Hawking, yes. Anyway, I wonder, because it was around 2017 that happened, the Obama interview.
Yeah, that's probably it. I can't imagine that you know, we may not have realized that's why the person was recommending it to us, but
I had no idea either until somebody was like, oh yeah, people are all into that book because Obama read it. I'm like, wait, what? Anyway, he must be really smart.
Well, that's a thing.
That's a thing.
Problem. That's a total thing.
I know.
That's an Uber thing.
It's a total thing. It's an overarching Uber thing.
I want to do a thing check-in. This is actually why I made the comment about being outside of time, because I don't think this is a thing per se that's new, right? It's not like, oh, I just noticed this. But honestly, with the sad news of Luke Perry dying.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of my friends started talking about their memories of 90210. And I started to realize there were people who hadn't discovered 90210 yet.
Wow.
There were younger people who are like, wait, the Riverdale guy, he was in a thing in the 90s? Whoa. And so I was like, we need to check back in on the state of 90s nostalgia. Like, we've definitely in the heart of 80s nostalgia, right? That's been going on for years, Stranger Things, et cetera. But 90s nostalgia has kind of been simmering with Friends being popular on Netflix, especially with millennials looking at it through rose. You know, we've talked about that before. But it's obviously not complete because not everybody has rediscovered 90210, which I think would be one of the top 90s nostalgia plays. Maybe I'm wrong.
I would think so. But that is really interesting that so much 90s nostalgia has been about sitcoms mostly. And then a little bit about style. But yeah, you would think so when they talk about it. So, okay, I'm looking at this Vanity Fair piece. And Beverly Hills 90210 is definitely in there when they talk about this 90s nostalgia craze. But it's kind of in the middle of the list after, like, obviously Friends, Seinfeld, Felicity, Dawson's Creek, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The X-Files, you know, and then it sort of eventually shows up.
Sarah Lane, the host on DTNS, was the one who had actual friends who were 10 years younger than her going, yeah, I don't know that show. I don't really know that show. I think I've heard of it. Yeah, I was like, wow. That's crazy. So I
get your 90s nostalgia act together, would you?
Yet to get to peak 90s nostalgia.
Yeah. If they have not come around to that show, you're absolutely right. And I'm not seeing a resurgence in Buffy. So clearly we have a ways to go.
There is a reboot being developed, so maybe once that finally releases, that will be the clarion call. That will be the kind
of I don't know if that's ever gonna go anywhere.
Well, it might not ever get released either.
So there was a lot of rage about that. A lot.
Well, I mean, that's also saying there were people alive and breathing and reading news, right? Like, you can't say you're doing anything without getting people upset. It's whether you can weather the storm, right? Bohemian Rhapsody. People were upset, but they weathered the storm.
I think the main reason that people were upset, honestly, is because Joss Whedon was sort of revealed to be, unfortunately, a dirtbag. And then it was like, you don't get to rehabilitate yourself on the back of Buffy.
That's the that's the backstory. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was one of those that was nope.
I think the reason that Bohemian Rhapsody weathered the storm is because a lot of people jumped to conclusions based on the trailer that ended up not being true.
Right.
They were like, you're totally whitewashing. Not whitewashing is the right word, but you're playing down the aspect of Freddie Mercury's sexuality, and the film doesn't play it down. You can definitely make criticisms of how it treats his sexuality, but it doesn't ignore it. And I think a lot of people thought from the trailer it was going to ignore it.
Right. They were like, oh, it's going to be this cisgender love affair between him and the. Yeah, exactly. When in fact, it was, I thought, a pretty nuanced treatment of the great love, but that wasn't enough. Yeah, it was fine. Plus, it's just a really big Queen concert. Like, get over it, people.
Not really. I mean, it really is just a big music video. That's, you know, if you go in with that feel, you're going to enjoy it. If you expect, like, an Oscar winning movie, you're not going to get it.
Then maybe not so much. Yeah, I wonder. I am very curious now to know whether 90s nostalgia, which really has been kind of a craze for several years now, but if it's going to go that deep. I don't know. It is really interesting. But the Vanity Fair article I found is from 2014.
Like all the decade nostalgia goes through the same ebbs and flows, but some are stronger than others.
Right.
I definitely feel like 50s nostalgia was much stronger than even 60s and definitely 70s.
Does 80s nostalgia, because it's awesome. Is there, even though I say that, but I'm definitely on the weird, I'm a cusp, a cusper. Yeah. Like I was not fully an 80s kid and not fully a 90s kid, because I just sort of like my formative years crossed
an 80s kid, and I don't find it that exciting. I'll be honest. I look at all this.
No.
That music was bad. I mean, I liked it then, but.
What would the, but like when by this Venn diagram will we get around to year 2000 nostalgia, and right. what's no. even going to go in there?
Right. Do you call it the O's, the aughts?
How are the they aughts?
Gonna, you know, how are they going to refer? We never solved that problem during the 2000s.
I think they're just going to have to stop at 90s nostalgia. Well, like that'll be it and start all over 20s nostalgia.
So you can have iPods and dot-coms and, you know.
Oh. True.
There's stuff.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I was going to say, is there going to be any like 1920s nostalgia? Like we'll just go all the way back, just do some big loop. Because it's too awkward to try to deal with 2000.
Get out. Forget it. We're just going to go back. We're going to go
no
all
can
the
do.
Way back. I would love that. That'd be great.
That would be hilarious. So I feel like I may have mentioned this in a previous episode, but I can't remember and I want to expand upon it. This is a little bit of a crossover thing, but I recently discovered that the reason... Okay, well, let me just simplify. One, Weezer is a thing. Like, it's Weezer, the band.
Yeah, like, forget 90s nostalgia or whatever. Weezer itself, separate from any other consideration, is a thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm not, like, 100% sure why, but it sort of is, and here it is. And then Weezer... has been enough of a thing that at some point there was an internet, and this is what I had not realized until somewhat recently, that the reason that Weezer remade Africa, that song by Toto, is because of an internet campaign started by like some 14-year-old, like a tweety, some kid on Twitter, going after Weezer. This whole, please retweet if you want to help make Ohio teen Weezer Africa's simple wholesome dream come true of seeing rock band Weezer cover Africa by Toto.
So if we're doing the meme detection, you know, the knowyourmeme.com people, have to dig down to find out where did the Africa meme come from.
Right, like why that?
Because then that feeds into the teen who makes the campaign, which then meets like two rivers colliding, the Weezer trend, and then explodes with Weezer covering it.
Exactly. And so there's like, oh, wow. It is so recursive meme tracing. But yeah, then apparently they did at some point, like this Twitter campaign went on for a pretty long time. There's a whole piece about it that I had open in one tab and I'm trying to find again that was basically like, I'm sorry, I did that. That was my fault. Like, I'm the person who made it blow up online and caused this insane Weezer thing to occur. And I would like to apologize because it's now insane. But it's so weird. I don't know. And it just felt like good. It's a thing trivia. Like,
what's funny is we were talking in our pre and post show on DTNS about Africa before the Weezer thing happened. And I'm guessing we were either subconsciously or certainly I subconsciously, maybe my co-host not so much, we're tapping into the Africa song meme that had started to kick around. Because when Weezer recovered it, we were like, what the? We were just talking about that a couple of weeks ago. That's crazy.
Yeah, why? I wonder. Okay, so that song Africa became a thing. Now, I know that one reason that song Africa had a resurgence is because that Kristen Bell and her husband did that hilarious video. They did because they're so freaking cute. Dax Shepard and Kristen Bell did their own music video to that song with like lip syncing and dramatic safari shots while they were on vacation.
That's
and
how it got in our zeitgeist.
I feel like that probably started it up because it was they were on vacation in Africa.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Yeah. And they were like on safari. And so they did this cute music video
Seems
and lip sync to it.
Seems likely that you could trace that.
I think you totally could. So that was 2016. Yeah. This is all, it's all starting to line up. How it got around to Weezer, I will never know. But now it's this fascinating double thing.
Yeah. How Weezer became a thing before the Africa Weezer thing. Yeah. That's
right.
That's for someone with more time and expertise than I've got.
It's too deep. And I like to call that our audience. Hello, yes, friends.
Please. For sure.
Help us out. If you know, please email us at feedback@itsathing.me.
Yeah. Apologies if anybody was popping into the Discord to listen to this episode record. I'm on the road, so I don't have my normal rig to do that. But we will, once I'm back in the saddle at home, continue to do that. And if you didn't know we did that, hey, if you're a patron, you can hook up Discord to patreon.com/itsathing. And often, most of the time, listen to us record the show.
Yep. Boom. And also, I want to apologize for being sick last week.
I'm sorry you were sick, but I thought Rich's idea of running an old It's a Thing as a sort of a flashback was pretty cool.
So smart.
Yeah.
I know. It is really, it's pretty funny because, God, it was so long ago. So long ago. All right. What else you got?
Thing is photography, FAUXTOGRAPHY.
Okay.
The Verge's Vlad Savov had an article early February about the idea of photography and how it has gone from meaning, oh, somebody's manipulating images to try to pass them off as real. Somebody is innocuous Photoshop. Chop jobs, blah, 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 blah. It has gone from that to being something your phone does that you might have a hard time turning off, right? If you like really seriously, like, no, I just want to take the photo without any AI or processing or studio stuff. Like, it's getting harder and harder and harder to just, if you're using your phone anyway, to just take a photo.
Huh. You're totally right. I know exactly what you're talking about. Like the thing where it makes you look prettier, right? There was that weird iPhone camera gate where it was a filter that was making you look prettier.
Smooth
huh.
Your skin.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh.
So photography, of course, it's a pun. I can't resist. Spelling yo, YAUX for years. That I think is an interesting way of talking about Photoshopped and fake photos. We've had that forever, though. It's just been done in different ways. But the idea that it's now creeping into your own photography, and since so many people use their phones for photography now, the idea that your camera isn't really representing reality. And do you mind? Do you care?
And do you mind? Yeah. It's funny. I wonder about that sometimes when I'm about to apply a filter to a photo. It's sort of like, is this real? Like, you have this sort of existential moment where you're like, am I actually misrepresenting this moment? Like, am I misrepresenting this memory? And it's not like there's such, compelling historical documents. It's just like a picture of my Uggs sticking out under a blanket with the dog there or whatever. But you start to, I don't know, like, I do sometimes take a pause and think, am I cheating here a little bit by making this photo look better than real life? But isn't that what we've always done?
Well, I mean, on one side of the argument, you don't ever represent reality with a photo, right?
Yeah.
It's not actually what you see. It's always something wrong. The colors are a little different. You don't have depth, right? It's two-dimensional. Mm-hmm. So you can make, the argument that, like, well, a photo is never real anyway. But there is sort of a built-in interpretation that translates, oh, that's what photos do. So I know that, well, the sky doesn't really look that blue, but that's roughly what happened, versus, oh, but when I look at this person in the photo and I look at them in real life, they don't look the same.
Right,
not
totally.
The same person.
So there is definitely the question about what in your life is or is not a lie.
Yeah.
There's that. I would imagine it's changed the dating scene quite dramatically. Like, oh, you don't look like that at all.
Well, and there's literacy for that, right? I assume that at a certain point you realize, oh, the photos I see on the dating app are never going to quite match up. And if they do, that's points to the person who submitted a realistic photo of themselves.
Then bravo. Yeah, that's true. This reminds me actually of this. I've read a couple stories about and seen, which is so amazing, colorizing, the sort of controversial practice of colorizing old photos, like photos that were taken in black and white, and just recolorizing them, and how jarring and startling that is. Like, it makes everything look so much more real. Like, you can look at these old photos and be like, those aren't real people. This doesn't make that much sense. But when you colorize them and then you look at something that's, you know, I found an old piece from Gizmodo from like 2014, and it's got a recolorized photo of the Golden Gate Bridge with all these old 1950s cars on it. And you're like, oh, that's what life looked like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, these photos are so not, they don't represent, like, life was still in color.
Right. Right. And it's fascinating because I remember asking my dad one time, I'm like, what was it like in the 40s? You know, one of those kind of questions. What was it like in the 40s? And this was probably when I was in my 20s and I was reading all these 1940s Life magazines and listening to 40s music and just really getting into the history and the vibe of that era. And I was like, you know, what did you feel? What was it? And he's like, I didn't feel any different. He's like, everything just felt normal. Like, we had cars and, you know, and food.
Totally. They were in color.
And he tried to explain it. He's like, I know things are different. Like, we didn't have VCRs and, you know, television was rare and not in color. He's like, but it didn't feel different. He's like, I don't look around today and go, wow, you know, I used to live in the 40s. He's like, it just changes so gradually that you don't notice it. And it felt normal. And I have to think about it differently. And that made me realize, like, oh, because I wasn't there, I can see all the difference. And I'm forced to see what you're saying is I'm forced to see the difference because I'm only seeing it represented in these flat two-dimensional black and white photos.
Right.
Whereas if that gets a little closer to reality, it starts to look more real and gets closer to what my dad was saying. Like, yeah, it just looks like life. It doesn't look that different.
Totally. And so then what's that going to mean when the historical record 20 years from now or 30 years from now, and everybody's having like a 2019 nostalgia.
The teens, yeah, yeah.
Then, and they look back at all these photos and they go like, well, that's not what life looked like. It's going to be almost, you can imagine that we would get to the point with filtering and photography where it would be as inaccurate a representation of the past as black and white photography.
Right. That's so freaky.
Right. And people will try to like unfilter historical photographs.
Oh, because they'll have machine learning.
Oh, they totally will.
Take the same filters and look at the world around them now and learn like, oh, this is the difference. Let me take those old photos and unfilter them. That's crazy.
Dude, totally. Oh my God. So weird. I love it. I love it. I love it. My thing is very pedestrian. By comparison, my last thing, which is that I was recently in LA, and so I'd be curious to know whether you've noticed this as well. And I noticed that the olive drab military jacket is such a thing that at one point, I'm not trying to call anybody out, but I'm just saying at one point I was in an office where I may or may not work, and there were like four desks lined up next to each other filled with younger workers, and every one of them had this jacket on, or some version of the olive drab military jacket. Yeah, and
across women and men, or just gender?
Like everyone was wearing one, and I was like, what is the deal here? Because, and I see it all over, and it looks really cool, and I'm always like, I want to buy that. But the thing is that when I go and DuckDuckGo for information about it, I like can't find anything. There's not a current article about the olive drab jacket trend. There is a piece in the New Yorker on how civilians are embracing military fashion, including quote war core. So that's kind of weird and upsetting. But even none of that is the olive drab jacket either.
First of all, I would say you should not have minimized this. This is pure thing, right? This is like core thing.
Yes. Have you seen it? Have you seen it around LA? Is everybody wearing the thing?
I definitely have. I have not seen four in a row like that. There's got to be a name for that. Like
that was hysterical. Yeah, it was like Inception or so. Yeah.
The first thing that makes me think of, in when you put it in this perspective, is that quote from Stripes, an '80s movie, which makes
look at you.
The quote from Stripes, where Bill Murray's character is talking about wearing the military stuff, right? Because he's joined the army, and he's like, chicks in New York are paying top dollar for this stuff.
And really?
Like, back then, military was coming into like a fashionable trend in the 80s. I wonder if there's some tie in there. If it's 80s nostalgia sort of subcurrent is pulling that along. Is it a reaction to sort of the winding down of unpopular wars that happened in both eras? I'm not saying which of these things or none of them or both of them, but it makes me think, like, what are the parallels between those two time periods?
I wonder, when does it become, and is it a period of relative distance? Also, you know, the khaki military jacket did become a thing again in the 90s, right into 2000. I'm looking at it now, khaki military jacket. Or is it a virtue of our relative distance from active? Yes, we're still at war in this country, but like, right. We don't think so, most people. But yeah, I wonder, it's a total. And then I almost wonder, because you know when it sprang into the consciousness again, this is horrible. But remember when Melania Trump went and wore that jacket? Where did she go? She went to the border.
Yeah.
She went to the U.S.-Mexico border, and she had a khaki military jacket that on the back said, I don't really care. Do you? And then that was like crazy and weird, but also it was a really cool jacket, like in the front.
Well,
and I wonder if that kicked off a new thing. Meghan Markle, J. Crew has one, the field jacket. Like what? And Meghan Markle just wore one the other day.
Like, did she end up causing? Did she end up causing that to go into the consciousness? Right. Not that people are actively like, I'm going to go now and wear jackets too. Right. Just sort of like everyone saw that image, and it just sometimes that stuff just kicks around in your brain. And you don't even realize it later when it comes back out, and you're like, "Oh, military jacket, that's cool, right?" Like,
I know. I wonder, did she incept it?
There was a recent interview on Justin Robert Young's Politics, Politics, Politics podcast with Joellen Posner of the Levy School of Business at Santa Clara University, where they were breaking down fashion and politics, and they talk about Melania's "I don't really care" coat, and what she thought of it, and what she thought it meant. And given that Melania definitely understands fashion, right?
Mm-hmm.
But she uses it in a different way, in a kind of an I don't care way, was I think the point she was trying to make there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a fascinating interview, first of all. You should go listen to that.
Definitely.
But I could see where that could have the unintended side effect of just...
Right. Jump starting again the kind of khaki military trend the khaki military jacket, now that I have the search terms correct, I mean, that is a persistent, that's a classic look, if you will, right? It comes and goes.
You're talking about it, it's sort of a perennial, right?
It is a perennial.
It just mutates a little bit here and there, but it never goes away, I guess.
But it is like really in right now. And I'm not really sure why, but there it is, the khaki field jacket. And sure enough, I feel definitely vindicated by finding a photo from just last week of Meghan Markle wearing the J. Crew field jacket edition khaki military jacket. Boom. Yeah, it's a thing.
There was
nailed it.
There was on that interview, she was pointing out that Kate William and Kate, what is she, the Duchess of Cambridge? She always wears something appropriate to where she's visiting, right? So if she's in Canada, she might wear red, in, you know, like the Canadian flag.
Oh, yeah.
She'll always choose designers from the region she's visiting, and it's this very subtle, like calculated commentary, you know, that says, hey, I'm on your side. I'm with you. I'm trying to respect the culture I'm visiting. It's weird how fashion.
Well, it's very interesting that you say that, because now I'm realizing that particular behavior has also become a thing. Like in the last year or so, I feel like there have been multiple, or maybe 2 years, like lots of instances of that. For example, when all the women wore black to the Oscars for Me Too. And then all the women, the new women joining Congress who've been wearing white to commemorate, you know, suffrage.
Right, right.
And I do feel like maybe that's becoming a little more like it's common.
Elevated.
It's like,
yeah.
Like it's being elevated, yes, mm-hmm. as an art form, like a sartorial art form.
Right, right.
Mm.
More intentionality behind it.
We got a sub thing.
Ah.
Dang.
This is the brilliance of doing the show.
And this is why.
To congratulate ourselves when I say that. I mean, it's the fun of doing this show.
It's why it's so fun. Exactly. Yeah. It's why we always want to. Oh, and I would like to say I just found a Forbes article on how indeed the utility trend is, quote, everywhere for the upcoming season.
The utility trend. And that
the military inspired khaki pants, mm-hmm. the jackets. Oh my God.
Well, there you go.
Totally
folks.
A thing.
Now you know what to dress in.
Now you know what to wear. you know what funny cultural things to talk about.
This may
you know
be
what
the
book to read.
Thing of the day.
This was a very thingy episode too. I am delighted.
Me too.
Hey, shout out to all of you who support the show. Thank you so much for being patrons. If you aren't already, you can find us at patreon.com/itsathing. And if you can figure out how to connect your Patreon to your Discord, A, you'll be a genius on the level of Stephen Hawking, and B, you'll be able to It's not that hard. Tom often tweets a how-to. You will be able to join us in the live chat where we post the links to all of these things in real time as we search them up on the internet.
Yeah.
So I think
fun.
It's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks.
You definitely want to do that.
Patreon.com/itsathing if you'd like to support the show directly. And even just at the dollar level, you get an ad-free version of the show. If you're like, I didn't
Perfect.
Know there were ads. They might show up from time to time. You just mm-hmm. don't know. But you won't get them if you're a patron. And there's also some kinds of perks in there as well. So go check it out, patreon.com/itsathing.
And email us, like we said, feedback@itsathing.me. Or of course, feel free to tweet us. I'm @MollyWood and he's @AceDetect. You know where we are.
You know
how to find us on the Twitter. All right. Thanks for joining us and enjoy the rest of your week of It's a Thing, which will be, in my case and all of you who are not Tom, South by Southwest FOMO. Here it comes.
Have some JOMO. It's not that fun.
Thanks, man. See you next week. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.